This is David Duke. And this is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast, broadcasting to the entire world with news and information of vital importance for Europeans and people of European descent, wherever they may live in the world. And today, I'm going to continue my spoken word version, and it's a free broadcast version of my book, Jewish Supremacism. And we're now well over halfway through the book. We're in Chapter 7. This is the third and final part to the roots of anti-Semitism, economic exploitation, and we're getting ready to go into a very fine part of the chapter dealing with banks and stock exchanges, the rise of the great Jewish banking houses, including a very interesting story of a great historical deception of the House of Rothschild in terms of the British stock market. And also, ladies and gentlemen, as you know, the days of the catastrophe in Lebanon continue on, and I hope people understand the roots of anti-Semitism. That's what these two chapters are about. The roots of anti-Semitism, one, economic, and two, the second one is going to deal, which will be coming up tomorrow, the first installment, will be the roots of anti-Semitism, crime, and treachery. So we have a lot to talk about here, and anti-Semitism is something, it's a word that's bandied about all the time, and it's so important that we have an understanding of where this word comes from and an interpretation that's not simply dependent on the Jewish extremists themselves, because that's exactly, as you've seen by the first part of this chapter, that's exactly who has come to define anti-Semitism for us. It's been the Jewish extremists themselves. How in the world can you know what anti-Semitism is or what it's all about if you only read a point of view that's biased? And that's precisely what we have in the West in terms of the view towards anti-Semitism. So enjoy this next part. I think you're going to find it very fascinating. This part is called Banks and Stock Exchanges. The first family of banking over the last two centuries has been the Rothschilds. From them came the most powerful banking houses of Europe. The founder of the House of Rothschild, Mayer Amschel Rothschild, was born in 1743 in Frankfurt am Main, Germany. Amschel studied first to be a rabbi and then decided to go into money lending and finance instead. He ultimately became the financial agent of the British government during the Napoleonic Wars and launched the greatest banking houses in Europe, with his sons going to the country's major capitals and establishing banks there. I read a very flattering book on the Rothschilds that related the story of Mayer Amschel's most famous financial coup. During the great battle between Napoleon and Wellington at Waterloo, the London stock market suffered as traders worried about the possibility of Napoleon's victory. Amschel saw the important battle as an unparalleled business opportunity, knowing that if Napoleon won, the stock market would crash, and that if France lost, the market would soar. Amschel set up a system whereby he would learn the outcome of the war before anyone else got the news. Using carrier pigeons over land and a series of boats with signal lanterns at intervals of a mile or so across the English Channel, he learned before anyone else that Napoleon had lost at Waterloo. He then had his Confederates put out the false information that Napoleon had won. This lie led to a devastating crash of the London Stock Exchange. Valuable stocks sold for pennies and dollar. Amschel and his Jewish associates, knowing that Britain had actually won, bought up the stocks for a pittance. Overnight, as the London market learned of the British victory, the stocks became worth a huge fortune. The book presented the Rothschilds' fraud as a clever and admirable act. One must pause to think about the fortunes lost, fortunes that had been acquired by years of toil and genius, of businesses literally stolen from their creators, of lives broken. Did the author think that this huge fortune simply materialized out of thin air? Did the author care that money comes not only from those who create and lead companies, but also from the hard work of thousands of laborers and employees? Such a theft affects salaries, working conditions, employment, and many other factors. Many hundreds of thousands ultimately had to pay the high cost of the Rothschilds' swindle. Mayor Amschel used the enormous wealth he acquired through his Waterloo scheme, among others, to establish his five sons, Amschel, Solomon, Nathan, Carl, and James, in their own banking houses across Europe. As discussed in my chapter on the Russian Revolution, the Rothschilds have readily used their massive wealth to influence nations on behalf of Jewish interests, as when they ripened Russia for revolution by canceling loans in protest over the Tsar's May laws. Rothschild's ill-gotten wealth also effectively bought his family the first Jewish seat in the British Parliament and even membership in the British aristocracy. By combining the power of their own family's huge banks and other Jewish-owned banks, they could literally bring a nation's economy to its knees. By dominating international banking, they could set their own financial terms to cash-hungry nations and amass even greater riches. Because of the competitive advantages of Rothschild's international contacts, Jews dominated private banking throughout Europe. For instance, there was almost a complete absence of Gentile banking firms in Prussia in the late 19th century. In 1923, Berlin, there were 150 Jewish banks and only 11 non-Jewish banks. In the stock market, schemes similar to Rothschild's Waterloo ploy have been used for generations, finally resulting in the center of world trading, Wall Street, becoming dominated by Jewish stock and investment banker operations. In the book Our Crowd, and a relatively recent one, The New Crowd, The Changing Jewish Guard on Wall Street, Jewish writers Judith Ehrlich and Barry Rehfeld fawningly relate the overwhelming Jewish takeover of the nexus of the American economy. Ivan Boesky and Michael Milken, who stole close to $2 billion between them, are glowingly praised for their brilliance and market savvy. When I was in high school, my father had some modest stock investments. His broker was a politically conservative Jew, Randy Newman, of the firm of Kohlmeier and Company. I got a job working for Mr. Newman, plotting curves, the term for charting stocks and commodities. At the time of my employment, I had little understanding on the Jewish issue. I liked Newman, and he always seemed to have a pertinent statement handy in response to the latest outrages of liberalism. Newman had made a fortune in the market, and while I worked for him, I discovered the real secret of making money in the market and the reason Jews have come to dominate the brokerage industry. Newman was constantly on the phone with his fellow Jews in New York, Chicago, and Washington, D.C. Each member of his circle knew other Jews as well, and a few Gentiles in business, government, and media, and at the critical junctures of the market. In his conversations, Newman often spoke using words that I could not understand. They were Yiddish. Occasionally, after the telephone conversation, he would quickly write out an order for a major stock or commodity purchase and have me run it to the clerk for submission. I remember frequent transactions that netted him tens of thousands of dollars just over a day or two. I asked him what his secret was, and he told me that he had no secret. Information, he said. That's how you make real money in the market. You have to get the information before the crowd gets it. Once it's in the newspapers, it's too late. He felt safe bragging to a quiet high school student, and I listened, and I learned a lot. Let's take the government, he said. Imagine you knew someone in the Federal Reserve who had inside information that Arthur Burns planned to raise interest rates. After all, someone has to know these things before the world knows. How could you do in the bond market, or for that matter, a dozen other markets that are extremely interest rate sensitive? Or how about if you knew a friend in the Department of Defense, and he knew if Lockheed or McDonnell Douglas would get the new fighter plane contract. Do you think you can make a fortune? Face it. Someone must know ahead of time. Or how about if your friends knew where the next military base would be opened? Think you'd do well in real estate? Or say you knew someone at the Justice Department who lets you know that they will drop their antitrust litigation against IBM. When the news comes out, what happens to IBM stock? Would you buy IBM stock? And it's not just government information that can make you a king's ransom. For instance, if you had friends at IBM and knew before anyone else that IBM was going to have a contract for 100,000 computer cases to a small company, what do you think might happen to that penny stock? There's a million ways, he would tell me, how information means money. I asked Newman if insider trading was illegal, and he told me, quote, they might as well make breathing illegal. He said it was technically illegal, but it was almost impossible to prove, and that it was not really even looked into except in the most blatant cases, usually involving huge amounts of money and high-profile people. Years later, such manipulation of enormous sums of money led to the biggest stock market scandal in history. In 1986, Dennis Levine, Ivan Bosky, Martin Siegel, and Michael Milliken were charged with insider trading of stocks and bonds worth billions of dollars. Bosky admitted his guilt and was fined $100 million, and millions more were eventually paid by Milliken, who, after all the fines and litigation and some jail time, still came out a very rich man. In 1987, Milliken made $550 million for his activities the year before, more than all but the top 41 of the Fortune 500 companies in the United States earned that year. Levine, Bosky, Siegel, and Milliken were guilty of the greatest financial fraud perpetrated since the Rothschilds' theft of the English Stock Exchange. It should also be noted that with their Jewish lawyers and facing Jewish judges, they served light sentences in minimum security federal jails for their enormous crimes. It's instructive to note how the Jewish power structure reacted to the Bosky affair. Some top Jewish leaders, including Lawrence Tisch, who later became top man at CBS, Felix Rohatyn, now U.S. Ambassador to France, and David Gordas, Executive Vice President of the American Jewish Committee, came together to do damage control. The Palm Beach Jewish World quoted Rabbi Gordas as saying that because of the arrest, Jews would be seen as exploiters of the economy and profiteers, unquote. If my friend Mr. Newman was right and inside information equals money, in a modern market economy, what does that mean for the most cohesive and organized group in the world? Many Jewish young people are as knowledgeable in finance from an early age as many Gentile kids are familiar with the star players of the Super Bowl or World Series. Ivan Bosky is an exceptional example only in the magnitude of his theft. Insider information of one sort or another is incredible power in the hands of people who know how to make use of it. Around the corner or around the world, it's the greatest weapon in an economic war. The spoils of that war, not only the luxuries that money can buy, but also the enormous political and media power that it purchases. The fact that tiny Jewish minorities often rise to economic dominance in Gentile nations of both the Mideast and Europe certainly played an important role in the repeated rise of anti-Semitism. Even when businessmen act perfectly legally, a cohesive and powerful team effort will consistently amass collective power over a scattered and individualistic mass. Such is the elemental nature of business. When the team strategy is combined with insider information garnered by Jewish penetration into upper-level administrative roles in government and business, the accumulation of incredible power is inevitable. I was soon to learn, however, that the secrets of Jewish financial success were far more than simply intelligence and team effort. I came to learn about an unexpected Jewish dominance in some of the most unsavory criminal enterprises that have ever afflicted mankind. It was time for me to investigate how the darkest sides of the Jewish character influenced the rise of anti-Semitism. I read that Jews have played a surprisingly powerful role in organized crime from ancient to present times. From having watched an endless stream of Hollywood movies portraying an Italian flavor to gangsterism, I did not expect the worldwide Jewish involvement in organized crime that made Sicilians look like very small time. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's the end of Chapter 7, The Roots of Anti-Semitism 1, Economic Exploitation. And tomorrow we'll go into Chapter 8, the beginning of Chapter 8, The Roots of Anti-Semitism 2, Crime and Treachery. And you'll find many things revealed in this chapter, a side of Jewish history and Jewish contemporary events that is thoroughly kept from public consciousness. One of the beginning aspects of the chapter will be a discussion of organized crime in the United States, and I will show you that over the last 100 years, the Jewish involvement in organized crime in America has been far greater than any alleged involvement of Italian organized crime. So it's incredible to understand this, and yet the media has basically kept this fact from you. And of course, you have a Hollywood media which is again controlled by the Jewish supremacists that have featured Italian gangsters and not the Jewish gangsters who have really wreaked havoc in many ways criminally in America. Well, until tomorrow, I look forward to seeing you then, and I hope that all of you listening will continue to support my work and the work of DavidDuke.com. And remember our friends, and remember the suffering that's going on in Lebanon right now. Lebanon is Jewish supremacism in action. It's hatred, bigotry, violence, murder, and death. And it's criminal in so many ways. It's important we understand what anti-Semitism is, a word that's bandied around by the media that has no real meaning today. These two chapters will give you a very good fundamental understanding of, you know, why there has been opposition to Jewish organized power historically. Thanks so much. I look forward to being with you tomorrow. This has been a David Duke Worldwide Web Radio broadcast. For more information and to support our vital work, please visit www.DavidDuke.com.